Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted Leave in the EU referendum in 2016.
Hello, and my name's Jazza. I've tried a new thing on Grindr, the gay dating app recently, where I have a few emojis, the flag emojis, at the top of my profile. They are the Union Jack, because I'm very proud of this island I'm from, the European Union, because I'm proud of my continued citizenship of that political project, and an LGBT rainbow flag, because, I mean, I'm gay, I'm on Grindr. For the first time yesterday, I got rejected because of the EU flag.
Oh my god.
He was like, "Hi, here's a photo of my face. Hey, what are you into?" 5 minutes. I didn't respond because he wasn't that hot. And then he responded with, "Oh, don't worry, just saw the EU flag." And then I went onto his profile and he was like, "Not into any of the EU Ramona types."
And I'm like, you are an EU remote aside.
Yeah, I'm one of the worst, probably, actually.
Yeah, you're not that bad. You're actually quite understanding of Leave voters.
Understanding, but still very much lean into the moan part of Ramon.
You do moan, that's mm-hmm. true. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I remember when I was doing online dating, there were a lot of profiles where it said no Tories. Yeah. No Brexiteers as well, or no Brexit supporters. But no Tories actually probably came up more than that, I think.
Yeah, I have a friend who's a Tory, and he just keeps it secret now. And like lets the girls end up liking him, and then it was just like, surprise Tory.
That's the strategy, man. That's the way you gotta go for it.
If you have a personality defect, Tory is a defect.
Wow.
Then
it's a good job Nick Massey isn't here.
Yeah,
you know,
former
Tory.
He's not a Tory anymore, is he?
Yeah.
Speaking of Nick, no, we're not going to segue from Nick Massey. We meet weekly, sometimes, to talk about politics, social issues, and current events. What are we talking about this week, Jimmy?
I think we're starting off with a general Brexit update, including the fact that since we last met a week ago, as listeners will be aware, Theresa May has reached out to Jeremy Corbyn in the modern vernacular. Of our times.
And has made, did you see the really awkward vlog video that she made where somebody couldn't keep the camera straight, kept on hitting it, and she kept on stumbling over her words, but it was her being hashtag authentic.
I mean, the first vlog that anyone does is a disaster, as you'll be well aware.
How dare you? I came out of the proverbial womb being able to vlog beautifully.
That's a bit weird, but okay.
Also, wouldn't adhere to YouTube's parental policies at the moment. Anyway, go on.
I mean, Theresa May is also old, and old people are bad at technology, so... Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But she is now, because the European Research Group, the right-wing kind of hardcore Tories within the Conservative Party, have basically made her life a living hell for the past year or so. She has decided, "I'm not going to work with you. We're going to pivot to the Labour Party and see if we can get a deal through that way," essentially. Mm. Basically, one of the, I think... A lot of people in my camp think this is a good thing because it's basically taken hard Brexit off the table. The likelihood of hard Brexit has gone down hugely because of these talks, because anything that is agreed or that would be agreed with the Labour Party is almost definitely going to include a guarantee of there being no hard Brexit, right?
Yeah. I mean, not because of Corbyn so much, but because of the Labour Parliamentary Party in general, and also the Labour membership, which is very pro-Remain.
Yvette Cooper. I want to live in that alternate universe where she's leader.
Yeah.
Anyway. Also, we're going to be kind of pontificating, because we love a little bit of hypothesising here on the Right Dishonourable, when Brexit sucks out all of the news in the blooming room. We're going to talk about the prospect of the UK, if we end up with a longer extension of Article 50 and staying in the EU longer than anybody was really expecting, of us possibly having to take part in the European elections that are coming up in the next couple of months, and what they would look like, and whether or not I should run. I shouldn't. It's always a bad idea.
Would you run as a member of the Tory party or a member of the Lib Dems?
Do you mean Change UK? Or the Lib Dems.
Aren't you a member of both the Tory
Party? Oh, I am a member. I keep forgetting I'm a member of the Tory Party. Sorry.
And you're also, you used to be a member of the National Rifle Association, which doesn't run in the UK. But,
No. But I did for a whole year get a load of stacks of publications about my gun rights.
That you don't really have because you're not a US citizen.
No, I didn't really have. Which was, you know, I like to join organisations and then troll them from the inside. I would, were I like the running kind of person, then I would probably, I mean, I'm a Lib Dem through and through, you cut me and I bleed Nick Clegg.
I mean, Change UK are the Lib Dems, but they haven't come to terms with it yet.
Yeah, there will eventually be some kind of an alliance, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But it would be... Well, we'll talk about that and how interesting it would be to have all of these smaller parties that tend to be anti-Brexit perhaps come to the fore in a proportionate voting system, which I think would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then finally, Jimmy, what's happening in Birmingham?
I think you're actually much closer to this story than I am.
Yeah, which is why I want you to introduce it
badly.
Mm-hmm.
So a school in Birmingham called...
Alston Primary School.
Alston Primary School recently tried to introduce LGBT friendly lessons about relationships,
which is national legislation.
Right. Introducing the kids to the idea that some families are not composed of straight parents.
Mm-hmm.
And this, because a lot of the children who attend the school are from Muslim families, there was a huge uproar about this and protests on the street. And the school has backed down, and I think a number of other schools have actually had a similar situation develop, although you can probably correct me on the details of that. And I guess, as you say, it's national curriculum that they have to follow. But it does bring up this interesting question of what right does a parent have to dictate things like relationship education in their school?
PSHE.
Where can they demand that their children be withdrawn from those lessons? As I think in my school, during the sex ed lessons, the parents had the option to say,
"I take people out."
Those were just general sex ed lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we're going to be discussing that.
Yeah. So it's Parkfield School. Alston Primary School is another school that was rolling out the same materials.
Right.
Which was called No Outsiders, which is meant to be inclusive of people of all races, sexualities and genders.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't want that, would we?
No.
I may be biased. So we're going to play some music, ask you for money. We like that very much. Thank you. And get on with it. Good?
Yeah.
If you have listened to The Right Dishonourable before, you will know that we have been unsuccessful in convincing anybody with money to sponsor the podcast. That's okay, though, because we have a Patreon where you guys, the listeners, can support us for as little as $1 per episode. And this really, really does help us. We have a load of overheads like web hosting fees, which are more expensive than you'd think, and keeping our equipment up to date. And also, it's nice for the effort that Jimmy and I put into this for us to get any kind of financial reward from it. Don't you think? I don't know. Anyway, PSA over. Let's get on with the show. Right, Jimmy. So now that Theresa May is trying to reach across the aisle, quote unquote, I kind of hate that phrase. Although it is very accurate because there's literally an aisle down the middle of the House of Parliaments. In order for her to be able to try and pass basically what is going to end up being her Brexit deal, like there's going to be very little change in her Brexit deal, but she needs the votes, and so now, out of desperation, she's reaching over to what people in her party are calling a Marxist. She's had people leave the Conservative
Whip. Is it fair to say Jeremy Corbyn's a Marxist?
He's probably a bit of a Marxist. But also they are using it as kind of like... Yeah. But they're using it as kind of like in a bad sense of the word. I'm sure lots of people think that Marxism is fine. And
well, I'm sure you saw when they... this was announced over a weekend, I can't remember which one, but on Twitter there were loads and loads of photos of Tory members cutting up their membership cards.
Yeah, I kind of enjoyed that, because then that means my vote in the Tory party is going to be a lot more powerful.
Yep, that's true. But so you didn't tear up your membership of the Tory Party?
No, I didn't. I ensured that my membership was still valid. I tell you, I'm going to take it out from the inside, or change it from the inside.
It's a mark of how unimportant this podcast is that nobody has thought, I need, you know, no Tory official.
No Tory.
It's been like, yeah, I need to go look up this Jazza John guy.
Yeah, exactly. But she is really kind of risking the unity of her party now by doing this.
Yeah, and I think it's the only explanation for why she didn't do it sooner in the process is that, like her predecessor, David Cameron, Tory unity is seen as more important than, I won't say what's best for the country, but, you know, what makes sense, shall we say.
Let's just say that.
Yeah, I mean, from a certain point of view, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Do you... So, one of the criticisms that I'm sure I've mentioned on the podcast before, and that I heard from a lot of commentators, was that this is something that she should have really done as soon as... If not as soon as she came into power, at least as soon as she lost her majority in the 2017 election.
Yeah, people said that at both of those times, yeah. Actually.
The need for there to kind of like be the equivalent of a national unity government or a grand coalition of the two largest parties represented in parliament to be able to come to some kind of consensus rather than there being what is now branded as like a Tory Brexit by the left and a soft Brexit by the right.
For that reason, though, I think it would have been difficult for... her to get an agreement with Jeremy Corbyn quite early on in the process because
you need the desperation.
You need some level of desperation, I think. Yeah, so maybe that played into her decision making when doing that. Yeah, but I mean, it would have made sense. It was a good idea when it was first suggested. So
there were a handful of options. She had meetings with Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron, who are respectively. Well, if you don't know this, then. Why are you listening to this podcast? But the Chancellor of Germany and the President of France. So they're being very good cop, bad cop. I'm kind of enjoying it. Emmanuel is being like the, you guys need to just leave, but we are not scared about our Brexit. And also like voicing the concerns that we had from some of the right-wing conservatives like Jacob Rees-Mogg, who were like, if we end up having to partake in the European elections, then we need to be really difficult.
I do think it is a bit of a farce that we're going to be participating in the elections, but...
Do you think that that's actually going to happen? Do you think the extension is going to push us past the elections deadline?
Yeah, so we should say we're recording this on April the 10th,
yes,
which is the Wednesday, and Theresa May is currently having a meeting, an emergency EU summit with... the various EU leaders.
The umpteenth of many.
Yes. And, I mean, the legal position as it stands is that we actually undertake a no-deal Brexit on Friday at 11 o'clock.
Yeah, but there's a consensus that that is almost definitely not going to happen, right?
It seems as though it's not going to go that way. I hope it's not going to go that way because this podcast is going to be rendered pretty irrelevant if she comes out the meet again.
I mean,
that's what transpires.
We've done this. But we...
But yeah, to answer your question, I think the European elections are on May 22nd, I want to say, or around then, towards the end of May.
Just after Eurovision.
Yeah. I mean, local authorities who are the ones charged with organising those elections have been told that it's likely that they will take place.
Mm-hmm.
And admittedly, if Theresa May says something, it's no guarantee that that's actually what's going to happen.
Mm.
But they've been told to start preparing. And actually, I think they, if memory serves, they have to file their electoral notices on April the 14th or something, or April the 15th.
Which the independent group, the Lib Dems, already have. I'm not sure if...
I was talking about the local authorities, but yeah, I think if you're a political party, you have to file your paperwork at some point, which is why Change UK / the independent group, CUC, or CHUCK, or... It's a really shit name. I mean...
You couldn't have... Like, guys, you couldn't have workshopped this. You've been planning this for years.
One of their only tasks, really, would have been to come up with a good name. But it's like when you put a new band together, it's very difficult to gain consensus.
Well, you are the expert.
I'm an expert on putting failing groups together. I think... I mean, do you fancy Change UK's chances in the European elections.
I'll put a pin in that and we'll come back to that when we talk about the possibility of us actually taking part in them.
Right.
But do you think that, what do you think of the likelihood of us going for a... There seem to be two options. A short extension, which is what Theresa May wants, and a longer extension of up to or around a year that the European Union seems to be talking about. Because, frankly, if we have a short extension of just a couple of months, the likelihood of things actually changing from our end are very, very small.
Why would they change over the course of a year?
It allows for there to be...
A proper renegotiation.
And also, if need be, as is often called, apparently, by Philip Hammond, another democratic event. So that would be a general election, which is what Labour still want, please stop, or a hashtag people's vote.
Such a troll. I mean, it's all pretty disastrous, isn't it? But I mean, a general election, if you look at the current polling and, you know, admittedly polling, usual caveats, and we have to go for a campaign, who knows what would happen, but it seems like...
Yeah, somebody could eat a bacon sandwich again.
That's true. Although, actually, Corbyn is a vegetarian, so I don't think there are...
Ed Miliband was Jewish, so...
It's true.
I think he still is Jewish. Yeah. He hasn't...
Not a religiously observant Jew.
Well, no. Well, so. Clearly.
Well, maybe he just doesn't buy into the bacon thing. You know, he's like, I see where you're going with the general gist of this, but the bacon rule, I can't.
Yeah.
I've tasted it now. It's too good. But yeah, I mean, it seems like a general election would return a hung parliament, perhaps a hung parliament with Labour having a plurality of seats rather than Tories.
That means the most.
It means the most, but not majority. Yeah, that's a better way of saying that. And I mean, it seems like a second referendum could end up in... I'm not really sure it would solve. Because, I mean, I suppose the hope of the People's Vote campaign is that we would vote... say 55-45 remain. Obviously they would want more, but they, if they could get something like that, they could say the people have spoken, they've had a rethink, and we're just going to remain in the EU now. But although that does actually deal with some of the immediate pressures, I think long term that doesn't really seem to solve anything. Unless you're assuming the tensions can be just pushed down long enough for enough old people to die that Leave Us become a, you know...
But I feel a small minority. From my perspective anyway, I feel like the longer we... I want it to be a long extension, because I think the longer that we... the extension is, the more likely it is for us to have a... I want a people's vote. Spoiler. Noticed that yet?
You were against a second referendum for a long time, though. And it's relatively recently you've come around to supporting it.
Yeah, well, because I think it's a really, really... I think it's the only practical way out of this mess. Because we know the flaws of, like I said, of a another general election, because people... And also, we should not be forced to vote on a binary question to send people to the House of Commons, where people whatever government ends up in power will be passing stuff on a whole range of things. I don't think we should be having an election just based around our status in the European Union.
But that didn't happen last time, when it was kind of obvious, like intuitively speaking, in the 2017 election, you'd have expected Brexit to be the main issue, and it wasn't.
And
really.
It wasn't. But I think it's practically impossible for that not to be the case if we had a general election now. And what the reason I like a people's vote now as well is because what is voted on, if we have my solution to this whole mess, which obviously we should, but will we? Probably not. If we have a three-way vote of Theresa May's deal, or whatever deal is on the table, no deal, and remain in the European Union, because they are all concrete things that, if needed, could happen tomorrow. They aren't a hypothetical of, oh, yeah, vote for Jeremy Corbyn to renegotiate another deal so that it's not a Tory Brexit, it's a Labour Brexit. That's a pie-in-the-sky dream that nobody knows actually exists yet. We have three things that actually exist now.
And you'd have some sort of runoff system whereby the least,
preferential voting,
the least popular thing would be, option would be eliminated, and then those votes would pass to the other one. I mean, from a practical level, I could see that that would work, but...
And frankly, Jimmy, right now, don't we need practicality? Isn't that the one thing that the whole process has been missing?
I think the cat's out of the bag on this one. I mean, put it this way, if we remain through some sets of circumstances, the stab in the back narrative has already been like well established and set up. And you might say, well, Brexiteers have been hopping mad for 30 years, so what's another 30 years of them being hopping mad? Equally, if we leave by some mechanism, either through Theresa May's deal or no deal, as there was an article in The Economist that reported this, a portion of Remainers have been, The Economist used the word radicalised, but you know, energised.
Oh, 100%.
To such an extent, there is now a Europhile movement in the UK.
Who won't? So I wouldn't. I know that we joke about it, but I wouldn't count myself as part of that because I think that I would completely have to reassess my attitude towards the European Union if we left and then reapplied.
But a lot of people, I don't think, make that distinction.
I don't know.
In that movement, anyway.
I a lot of people who, like, I was marching with a couple of weeks ago are genuinely like, well, if we leave, then we have to start campaigning to get back into the European Union. And I don't think that would necessarily be the best thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. A lot of them don't feel the same way you do. I think one way or the other, you've said it previously, but we are going to end up arguing about Brexit or the Brexit that didn't happen or Brexit in name only or, you know, whatever. So really, this referendum has solved absolutely nothing.
You know what? Part of me wants us to drop out with no deal on Friday and then give Boris Johnson the keys to number 10 and just see what happens. Because that's the only way you actually kill off this thing. You actually give them the power and watch them fuck everything up. But then I realise that, like, then people actually die and I stop thinking it's a good idea. But every now and again I do, like, muse on that alternate reality a little bit.
See, I just think the impact of no deal, and I'm only basing this off what I've read roughly, is that it will be disruptive, but actually it will be disruptive in quite diffuse ways that aren't necessarily that easy to connect to people's everyday lives. So you have like economic damage, but economic damage from the point of view of just people every day, it doesn't necessarily mean very much. I mean, it could mean potentially like higher prices in, you know, supermarkets and stuff like that, something like quite relatable and tangible in people's lives. But I actually think a lot of the impacts will be a lot, you know, more intangible than that. And therefore,
but then I want the ERG to be given any kind of responsibility so that then they can shut the bloody hell up and then we can start throwing eggs at them.
I mean, there was that opportunity before Michael Gove decided to...
Gove, I don't think, is quite ERG.
He's not. Enough. What I was going to say is if he'd continued not, to back yeah, back Boris right, yeah. and Boris Johnson ended up as Prime Minister, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want him as Prime Minister, but at least it would have created accountability because it would have been a vote leave premiership.
Yeah.
So...
What do you think about the prospect if we do get a longer extension as kind of like required by the as suggested at the moment by the European Union and we do end up voting, this is the second topic by the way, and we do end up voting in the European elections and sending 70, it would be, I mean, he would be very pissed off because they've redistributed all of the seats amongst the rest of the nations as well. Yeah. So they'd have to go back to 2014 numbers.
Yes, yeah.
Which was just like...
If we're still planning on leaving, it seems a bit weird, but I guess if we're leaving...
But I feel like, but legally, keeping, we have to. We're still citizens.
Yeah, if we're keeping Remain on the table, then... yeah, because apparently there was some debate around between the EU Council and... I don't know what the other body was. Some European legal experts thought that actually Britain could probably get away with not sending...
But then we would have to have left before Parliament sits.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, June something is when Parliament sits. If we'd not participated in the elections, but if our membership hadn't run into Parliament sitting, as you say, then that would have been fine. But the I think it was the EU Council took the view that that wasn't really acceptable. But that might have been more political or negotiating thing mm-hmm. than actually a practical legal reality.
So if we were to be going, what's really interesting about the European elections is that we vote regionally on a proportionate system. So it's like London, Scotland, East of England, blah, 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 blah. All of them will send proportionately a number of MPs based on population. That means, because of the proportionate system, it means that smaller parties can be very well represented. And also, because of generally lower turnout, the zealots, the reason that youth, let's be fair, the most engaged people will end up being more represented. So we've ended up, UKIP have been the largest party that we've sent to parliaments in a row, I think.
I don't think it was the one before, because that was the first time that a party that wasn't the Tories or Labour
were
actually the largest party in a significant election. Mm-hmm. So I think that includes locals and general election,
yeah,
going back probably to as far as when mm-hmm. Labour started being the second party.
We will end UK. up, if we do go into these elections, we'll end up with a really interesting smaller party kind of like dynamic, because we'll have at least two new parties on the scene.
You're referring to Change UK and
I'm
Nigel.
Not talking about Renew, that's correct.
Yeah, Nigel Farage's Brexit party. Which is not the same as UKIP.
But people will inevitably continue to vote for UKIP, right? They have great brand recognition. It's just now they're voting for the alt-right.
Yeah.
Basically, right?
Well, you know, you could overstate it, but yeah, kind of. Mm-hmm. Does anyone really know what the fuck UKIP's doing these days? They just pop up occasionally to defend Tommy Robinson, and then...
Yeah.
It's...
scary.
Yeah.
What do you think is the point of Change UK running when they are a distraction away from the main... kind of like stay in the EU, pro-EU party, the Lib Dems?
Well,
are they adding?
In that sense, probably not very much, but from their own interests as a political party, they want to get some seats in an election, because as you kind of alluded to, the European elections are elections where small parties can do quite well and actually clock up seats, which is why UKIP, despite only having ever sent one MP to Parliament,
two.
That was a defection. He didn't win his Mark mm-hmm. Reckless did not win his seat again when he stood as a UKIP candidate, having previously stood as a Tory one.
Mm.
UKIP managed to gain they managed to win a European election, i.e., get the most seats.
Mm.
And I think Change UK is very worried that when it comes to the next general election, their 11 MPs are very liable to lose their seats. Maybe, probably not all of them, but quite a few of them.
But most of them will, yeah.
And this offers...
Chuka Amuna, actually, probably one of the most likely.
Yeah, so I think some of them are in safer seats than others, and there's that whole argument about like local mandate.
Personality, yeah.
Local personality or whatever, which you don't buy. And I also don't buy, by and large, but... I think it makes sense from Change UK's narrow self-interest perspective as a political party, but their policy on Brexit is identical to the Lib Dems' policy on Brexit.
Yeah, it is interesting that there are two kind of like insurgent, there would be potentially two insurgent parties from either side of like the new dichotomy of British politics, which is like Remain or Leave. Who do you think ends up turning people out more? Does this end up being the one where the Remainers all of a sudden all wake up and all vote strongly? Or...
So there was...
Like, who is more fatigued? Who is less likely to actually turn out? Because if we go by March sizes, the Remainers are on the front foot, right?
Yeah, well, there was some YouGov polling, which Guido Fawkes posted today, which said that...
Friend of the podcast? Not
not really. Well, Tom Harwood is...
Tom Harwood's an old friend. I'm really enjoying trolling him at the moment, but anyway, that's another story.
I don't think he's listening, so it's not the most effective trolling it could be. But anyway, they suggested that when you tally up all the different parties that are going to participate in the European elections, should they happen, should the UK participate in them, you end up with I think it's something like 60% of seats go to Remain back leaning parties.
Does that include Labour?
I think that, yeah, that does include Labour. Okay. Because I mean, obviously the leadership of Labour, Jeremy Corbyn, people think he probably voted Leave, and people think that the leadership is very Eurosceptic. Mm. But the membership and most of the MPs and most of the activists are Remainers. Mm-hmm. So the flip side is obviously the Tory party, which is the mirror image of that. So, mm-hmm. So
how did Guido frame it?
Because
that's not what they like.
I can't remember how they framed it. I mean, they basically just said Europhiles are likely to do better in the European elections.
Europhiles. Sounds like paedophiles.
I think that's the idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, what was the Europhobes? Was in, you know, a term in track that had some traction at some point. But Eurosceptics is actually quite nice. And I think actually there's a lot of die-hard Remainers who literally would describe themselves as sceptical of the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's...
Who did best there? Was Labour still the largest?
I think Labour's... I can't... I mean, fair enough, you should pull it up on your computer, but... Okay.
Talk for a little bit and I'll see what I can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think... I mean, the Remain coalition is broader. It has Labour, the Lib Dems, Change UK, which haven't stood previously, so how they'd actually... you know, do in the event of an actual election rather than just a poll. Don't know. But and then you have Green and the SNP. I think they have European candidates.
Yeah, so Lib Dems would be on 8%, Change UK on about 4, Greens on about 4, SNP on about 4, Labour on like 38.
Yeah.
The Brexit Party would get 10%.
Yeah, Brexit
which
Party
is so
does better than UKIP, doesn't it?
Yeah, Brexit Party polls. Because Brexit is a strong brand.
Well, Nigel Farage's brand is strong. Mm-hmm. And he would get a lot of media coverage in the run-up to the elections, so they definitely have that going for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think in terms of, you know, in terms of media reach, the Brexit party probably will do better than UKIP, because Gerard Batten, the current UKIP leader, just doesn't have the same, you know, this doesn't generate the same interest from the media.
Mm-hmm. It surprises me that Labour dominates so much. Still, despite the fact that they are actually technically still a Leave party.
Yeah, well, this brings us back to the whole 2017 general election, is that actually 80% of people, or 82%, voted for parties that had an explicit commitment in their manifestos to take Britain out of the EU.
Yeah. But importantly, different types and different ways of taking Britain out of the EU.
Well, yeah. I don't know, it's a clusterfuck. And
that's our hot take. Jimmy,
hot take.
Why do you think that the government wants to shove gays down the throats of children?
That is a very, very unfortunate way of phrasing that.
It was deliberate.
Okay. Because there is a broad consensus now among, you know, the important people, that we are pro-LGBT rights now.
Who are you calling the important people, Jimmy?
Policymakers, leading politicians.
Podcasters.
People who work
think
tanks, leading businessmen, businesses, most of the media still. Certainly the broadcasters, you could quibble about the press. But most of the people who matter are pro-LGBT rights. So
this is the Parkfield... I'm trying desperately to segue into the Parkfield School protests and Birmingham protests, where parents of children in this primary school have been protesting long and hard about the fact that LGBT education is being included in PSHE classes for primary school kids. To be clear, so the course is called No Outsiders, which is meant to be kind of like inclusive of like they tell stories to children about people from diverse backgrounds, so that they know what like a Muslim family is, they know what like a Caribbean family is, they know what a same-sex family is, and all of that kind of stuff. To be very clear, there's nothing about the sexy sex.
It's not sex ed.
It is, no, it's not. No. It's PSHE, which is...
It's relationships education.
Relationships education. They don't learn sex ed until like 13 or 14. And even then, I don't know. Yes,
is it
sexual health education?
No, I think it's like personal health education. Or something like that.
But literally, it is. They are protesting content that presents the existence of people from diverse different backgrounds, and they've taken. They have a problem with the LGBT side of this. It's really depressing. As a gay person, spoiler, I spoke about Grindr at the top of the show. But it's really depressing and sad to see that people protesting me.
Well, there are still religious people in the UK. And Muslims are certainly not alone in this, because, you know, we've talked about Tim Farron previously. there are certain hardline religious people in the UK who basically don't think that homosexuality should be encouraged, would be the milder end of things, but allowed in, you know, the more extreme case.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a poll from some years ago that showed a majority of, I'm going to have to remember this right. There was a poll of actually even younger British Muslims that indicated that a lot of them thought homosexuality was wrong. Some of them thought it should be illegal. I don't think it was a majority, but I think it was a pretty high percentage.
Mm-hmm.
It's fair to say that the attitudes of British Muslims towards homosexual people are not great, mm-hmm, in general. So it's not surprising that some people feel this way. This is a policy. That's why I headed up this segment by saying the important people think that we should teach, children about LGBT relationships. But there's a largely religious minority,
mm-hmm,
that don't think that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the conflict is created.
It makes me really depressed how much it affects kids as well, because kids don't care. And kids aren't prejudiced, and kids see that stuff and take it for what it is, which is just, if it's two men or two women holding hands, it's just two men and women holding hands. And they will often, when you expose kids, if you expose kids to this stuff, quite often their response is, okay. And it's not until they get told stories of why this is wrong, based on the prejudices of their parents or the people around them, that homophobia begins. We learn how to be homophobic. We don't. That's not something that you're born with, and we burned with the same with racism and anti-religious stuff.
I suppose so, but I mean, there is the one caveat to that is that there is, I think, an innate instinct towards in-group, out-group, mm-hmm, attitudes, mm-hmm, us and them. That stuff certainly is fairly instinctive in people.
Mm-hmm.
So even kids.
100%. But also, it makes it me really sad that this kind of education that I would have, I was, for want of a better word, gagging for. I never had any same-sex sex education or relationship education when I was younger. The only gay people I knew about were this one guy who had a storyline on Hollyoaks that I watched religiously for 2 months while they did his coming out story.
Mm.
And I didn't know how to have sex properly. I didn't know that HIV was a thing until I was 18. It was insane. I understand kind of some of the arguments of a parent should be able to decide what their children learn and when. But when it is something as innocuous as acknowledging the pure existence of people, that I find that very, very depressing.
It is depressing, but I think I'm sure you'd agree with me that actually when kids get older, they should also be exposed to LGBT sex ed as well.
100%.
So,
yeah.
I mean, this is
kind of... the stuff that they're doing here is think of the primary school children.
Yeah. But I imagine from the point of view of the protesters, it's a thin end of the wedge kind, mm-hmm, of argument.
Yeah.
It's like, well, it starts with just acknowledging these people exist, but then you know. And I guess from their point of view as well, it does confer a certain legitimacy, mm-hmm, on same-sex relationships, which is its intention.
Yeah.
And they don't want that. They want to... teach their kids that same-sex relationships are not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. And they're not an option for them.
Yeah, I mean, that is the whole, that's the whole argument, isn't it?
I cannot wait for same-sex sex education to come into secondary schools as a compulsory part of the curriculum in 2020.
Yeah.
That's going to be a riot, isn't it? What do you think about a parent's right to be able to dictate when their children are exposed to that kind of stuff?
I think this is something I've looked into in a great deal of detail, but intuitively it makes sense that kids are taught about relationships quite young, because I think it. I mean, if a parent is squeamish about relationships, in whatever sense you mean that, even if they're not bigoted against LGBT people, but they just think that they just feel quite uncomfortable teaching their kids. Well, not even abstinence education. I just think it's a reasonable thing for a government to do, to actually force schools to teach kids about relationships in a broad sense. And so, I mean, in that sense, I don't think parents do have a right to say that their kids can't learn about something.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I understand the conflict there.
Imagine if parents said that you're not allowed to learn about Pythagoras' theorem, or that you're not allowed. Imagine not exposing your kids to evolution.
Well, yeah, for example, I mean, that is a whole.
Which is something that like
that's still happen. Still an active argument in the US. It's not really
an argument here. I have a friend who taught English in like an American school in Taiwan, and had to teach evolution in like the biology classes.
Yeah.
No, creationism in the...
Okay. The thing, I suppose, you know, there's no... Somebody has to win. Mm-hmm. Either the parents get their way, or this idea of a national education gets its way. The idea that the government can legitimately dictate a certain amount of what every child is taught. But from my point of view, I think the interests of the child are more important than the interests of the parent.
What really depresses me is we're the LGBT community, and especially the tea part of the community, are a very vulnerable part of society in terms of our mental health and our mental well-being. We have some of the highest suicide rates in like across our society, and what these parents are doing is going to be so damaging for some of the children that are experiencing that. And even for people who aren't going into that school, for some of the kids who are seeing them being protested against, makes me really... It is heartbreaking.
Mm.
Because that's just going to make somebody less likely to be okay with themselves, feel less safe about their sexuality, feel less safe about being themselves. And there's real... And I don't want to be melodramatic, but there are real life consequences to that kind of stuff and the behaviour of these parents.
Yeah, I mean that is just true, I think. I suppose that there is a slightly interesting question around, because you've outlined if you grow up in a household where the parents are homophobic, say, to the extent that they don't want you learning about homosexuality in any capacity at school, you're probably going to have quite a difficult childhood anyway, but it's going to be made worse if the school doesn't
People my age in their late 20s, we all had a difficult childhood because there was just so little information. So there was the people who had a positive experience coming out and had parents who were like engaged with like LGBT rights and stuff like that are the minority. Mm. And we are just getting to a point where it's becoming more common for parents to not just be like, oh, it's okay, we don't care, to parents who know how to raise where there's resources to raise gay children. We are just getting there. And then to kind of have this roadblock is quite frustrating. Because that's all I wanted.
I mean, it's to be expected, though.
Doesn't stop it being shit, though, does it?
It's a bit shit. I suppose the other side of it, though, is do you run a risk of... I mean, I think you do run a risk of, with these policies, it probably does alienate some Muslims if they feel so strongly about this that, and they feel that the state is actually intervening in how they want to raise their children. That, And this is why, with the schools actually sort of walked back on the program, which I think
they've paused it,
right? Mm-hmm.
Which I think is the wrong.
Do you think it's wrong? Because I actually think they're going to need to find some sort of conciliatory.
I mean, that program is still, that education is still compulsory,
right?
And so now that school is choosing to not.
Yeah, but I think that they need to find some way of bringing the parents with them. Like, I don't know what that is, but I think that.
But when the leaders in those religious communities are the ones leading those protests, I don't know how you do that, and I don't know I don't know how we do that.
Yeah, I mean it. In some ways, I mean, I think you could say this is true to some degree also with, you know, even British Christian families that are, you know, very devout, very committed to their religion and have these views and actually don't approve of what schools are teaching their kids. But there's like a core broad consensus. Most people think this sort of thing is fine.
Mm.
And then there are some minority groups, whether they be British Muslims or certain Christian groups or whatever, that don't. And it's one of those things in a broadly liberal society that you actually have these small groups that kind of don't really fit in very neatly.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds like a harsh thing, but you know that, you know, it's one of those things that to some degree groups can't really rub along together. You're going to have to piss someone off.
But I think those groups, and we've talked about this in the past before, a long time ago though, you can take those groups along with you. It is possible to be Muslim and it is possible to be Christian and believe in LGBT rights and LGBT education, despite what how people interpret those religions. The thing that it takes is time. Because you see it with the number of Christians and even parts of Christianity like Mormons, where now LGBT rights are kind of like seen as a really positive thing and something that is integrated into those societies. And I am convinced that we will see that with the Muslim community as well. I don't think there's anything special about the Muslim community and LGBT rights. It's just, it's at a different stage that the other Abrahamic religions are at.
I mean, I think it could develop that way. I'm not sure if, I'm not sure I agree that it's inevitable necessarily. I
think we have to make it inevitable.
Yeah, but ultimately the government does have to. It's sort of well, in some ways, I'm suspicious of the government intervening in what is essentially an ideological question. But I mean, the government, by its very existence, has to do that to some degree.
Like every day.
Yeah. It would be nice to think that you can live in a liberal society where the government is, in some respects, politically neutral.
Mm.
But you know, in some respects, it has to choose a side, and if you do nothing, that is also choosing a side. If the government actually decides and says actually we're going to allow a divergence in what our schools teach our kids, to the extent that some schools are, if not promoting homophobia, then certainly not doing anything to combat it, that seems bad. I think, but you know, that's it's a matter of political judgment at the end of the day.
Lol, 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 lol. Fun.
We managed to go from Brexit and actually make it more depressing. So,
look at us, aren't we impressive? Please do find us on Twitter at Right Dishonor. You can find me at Jazza John and Jimmy.
Oh, at JDE Nichols.
Lovely. Please do leave us a review. They genuinely do help us. We haven't had one in a while. Please love us.
Yeah.
We'll see you next time.
Well, they'll hear us next time.
Okay. Bye.